Environmental Law Monitor. I'm your host, Daniel Pope. This podcast is brought to you by Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Practice Group, and it's a place for thoughtful conversations on environmental and natural resources law and policy. We have conversations ranging from the latest developments to perennial topics like litigation, enforcement, and compliance assurance. We're glad you're spending some time with us today. Is this thing on? It's been a while. It has been a long while since we have recorded a podcast episode of the Environmental Law Monitor. And I've heard from some of you in person, that you were wondering when the next episode is going to come out. Well, here it is. A little bit of a personal update. I was out for a good bit of the summer on paternity leave. My wife and I welcomed our third daughter to the family. And I think that expands the potential for dad jokes on this podcast significantly. And so that was wonderful to spend some time with our new little girl. And the firm was kind enough to let me spend that time. The branches of the federal government, all three branches, decided to use my paternity leave as an occasion to do some pretty major things. We had a major Supreme Court case in Sackett versus EPA. We had, Stephen, I think I've mentioned this to you before, I don't think there's been any federal legislation affecting environmental laws as such during my time as an attorney, during my time at Bracewell. And we got NEPA revisions in the Fiscal Responsibility Act. Imagine that. And then, of course, the executive branch proposed new NEPA regulations and has been doing all manner of things. So it was an eventful summer for me for a lot of reasons. But fortunately, I got to spend some time with my girl. Now, we've had a number of energy transition topics on this podcast, but we haven't paused to look at what I think is one of the most significant drivers of the energy transition, and that is the role of tax incentives or tax credits in driving or incentivizing a lot of different kinds of new projects, from renewable projects, wind and solar facilities, to carbon capture facilities. And fortunately, today on this episode, we have one of the preeminent experts on these issues, and she's right under our own roof, so to speak. Liz McGinley is a partner in our New York office. She's joined us here today. She's the chair of our tax department, and she's advises all manner of clients on the tax implications of investments in oil and gas, renewable power. And she's been recognized by several different organizations for her leadership and mastery of the tax issues we'll be talking about on this podcast today. And Stephen, while not a tax expert, has had really significant roles in companies like Lyon Double Cell. He's also been at EPA before as a deputy assistant manager of EPA's Office of Land and Emergency Management. So Liz is going to help us get familiar with some of these tax incentives, especially after some significant changes we saw with the Fiscal Responsibility Act. And then we're going to talk about some of the implications for these incentives for environmental and tax compliance professionals in companies. So welcome, Liz. Welcome back, Stephen. It's so good to be in the studio again and to be with you both.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks, and good to have you back.
I appreciate it. Now, Liz, I'll turn to you first. We've seen a lot of activity coming out of Congress over the past few years dealing with various kinds of tax incentives, tax credits. And I think in my time at Bracewell, I've heard you present on tax credits several times. But the Inflation Reduction Act had some significant effects on these tax credits. Could you walk us through and give us the lay of the land as it is today?
Sure, absolutely. The Inflation Reduction Act, which was enacted into law in August of last year, was incredibly significant in terms of federal income tax incentives for the energy transition. It expanded and extended credits for wind and solar power. It enhanced credits for carbon capture, created credits for clean hydrogen and clean fuels, among many other incentives. But my area of focus is the carbon capture credits, clean hydrogen credits, as well as clean fuels credits. And they all are correlated in that all three often involve, as part of the process, carbon capture and sequestration.
Excellent. So what have you seen since that August 2022 enactment of the IRA?
Sure. I'll tell you kind of how it has changed the landscape. And I'll focus first on how it has impacted the carbon capture industry. I have been active in the carbon capture industry, advising clients on credits, transaction structures, monetization of credits since early 2019, after the credits were enhanced in 2018. And we have been involved in a wide variety of projects representing emitters, adding carbon capture equipment and claiming credits, midstream companies developing pipelines to transport CO2, as well as clients that were either developing secure geologic storage for the disposal of CO2, as well as the use of CO2 for EOR and the utilization of CO2 to produce other commercial products, all of which potentially eligible for the 45Q credits.
And when you say EOR, that's enhanced oil recovery?
Yes, that is the shorthand. And the credits are actually available for the use of CO2 for enhanced oil or gas recovery. But those of us who have been in the energy industry for a long time often just shorthand that as EOR. So what was really significant around the Inflation Reduction Act, while folks were developing carbon capture projects relying on the incentives under the code prior to the IRA, the most significant changes to the carbon capture credits in the IRA were that they extended their availability. They increased the credit rates if the taxpayer complied with the prevailing wage and apprenticeship requirements. And it also reduced the threshold capture requirements, allowing smaller projects to more easily qualify for the Section 45Q credits. So probably of all of those changes, what was most significant was the change in the credit rates for carbon capture and sequestration. And prior to the IRA, most of the carbon capture projects we were seeing were pre-combustion capture of CO2. So that was most typically carbon capture with respect to ethanol facilities or natural gas processing facilities. There were two advantages there in both categories. One is the cost of carbon capture equipment for pre-combustion capture of CO2 is a relatively low cost. Also, in both of those industries, the emission stream that is able to be segregated is a fairly pure stream of CO2 as opposed to other gases. And the reason why that is significant is that the credits are only available with respect to carbon oxides, and that's generally understood as carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide, which is captured and disposed, injected, or utilized in accordance with the regulations. So the lower cost of the equipment and the higher concentration of CO2 eligible for the credits was a real driver to see CCUS projects early in gas processing and in ethanol facilities. And I will add to that, the ethanol carbon capture also enhanced the producer's ability to claim California low carbon fuel standards credits, which was yet another incentive. But with the increased credit rates following the IRA, we saw an increased interest in carbon capture for post-combustion projects, including adding carbon capture to power producers, natural gas or coal-fired power plants.
And that's really been one of the goals, right? Like if you could make it more attractive to a variety of different kinds of power generators, then you would start to see real gains, at least for one of the purposes of these carbon credits, is to incentivize people to capture their carbon emissions. And those are some, you know, those are the big leagues, I guess, that the IRA helped us get to.
Right. Very large potential emitters, including other industries heavily reliant on fossil fuels, steel production, cement production. And those were slower to develop because unlike the pre-combustion capture, in post-combustion, the equipment tends to be more expensive. Of course, it's project dependent, but generally it's more expensive. And also the emission stream may have a lower concentration of CO2. So there's potentially a lower percentage of emissions that when disposed, injected, or utilized would be eligible for the credits. So all of that was slower to advance, but now we have seen much more interest in that. And I think that is in part due to the additional proposed EPA regulations on emissions from power facilities. So it was kind of a confluence of events that we've seen more activity in that area recently. So that was a real driver that we saw change post-IRA. And something really significant in the IRA, not directly related to the amount or qualification for the credits for carbon capture, is the expanded ability to monetize these credits. Prior to the IRA, generally, these credits were valuable to taxpayers that were able to claim them and use them to offset their cash tax liability. However, there are many very successful emitters out there that do not have cash tax liability. They may have a lot of what we call non-cash deductions, depreciation and amortization, especially if they're in growth mode and doing a lot of capital development, so that they would not have positive taxable income and they would not have cash tax liability each year, which would inhibit them from covering the true value of the tax credits because they either couldn't use them or they would have to carry them forward to future years to offset future cash tax liability. The one way that was most common to try to monetize the credits for those taxpayers prior to the IRA is a structure called a tax equity investment. And very generally, what that is when the credits are earned in a partnership and an investor who could utilize the credits comes in and makes a capital contribution to that project in exchange for future allocations of depreciation and tax credits and possibly cash as well over time to recover their investment. While those are certainly a fairly commonly recognized structure in the industry, they were a little slower to develop around carbon capture deals because carbon capture deals presented some complexities that those who were accustomed to doing tax equity deals in the wind or solar space had not seen before. And there were also some technical issues around tax equity for carbon capture projects, which is why they were a little slower to develop. But the IRA, quite fortunately, brought us two more means to monetize these credits. So the carbon capture credits, as well as the clean hydrogen credits, generally are available for refund for the first five taxable years of the project. So what that means is if you do not have cash tax liability to offset, or to the extent the credits exceed the cash tax liability you have to offset, you can actually treat the credits as a cash payment of taxes or an overpayment of taxes, and then claim a refund from the federal government for the amount of credits in excess of your cash tax liability. Thereafter, you are able to transfer the credits or effectively sell the credits to any unrelated taxpayer in exchange for cash. Now, the slight downside of transfers or sales of credits versus using them to offset your own cash tax liability or getting a refund, what we refer to in the tax world as direct pay, is that if you're selling the credits to a third party, most likely that is going to be at a discount, right, to incentivize the buyer. So the buyer would be able to use the credits dollar for dollar, but they may pay, 90 or 95 cents on the dollar for the credits. So still an incredibly effective means to readily monetize the credits, but that transfer credits to a third party typically comes at a discount.
Liz, this sounds like something that is for big corporations, venture capitalists, all these funds. And I draw on my experience at EPA when the Opportunity Zone tax credits came out during the Trump administration. I ran into resistance with some of the EPA career staff. This is just another tax break for the billionaires.
Stephen, for the benefit of some of us who may not know what those Opportunity Zone credits were, can you give us a high level?
Very simply, it was a tax credit of some sort. I don't know the details. I married a tax accountant, so I didn't have to know these details. That made it more investor friendly to invest in brownfields and other type of, you know, these underdeveloped areas, you know, what many of our folks, the environmental justice or other distressed communities. And some of the EPA career staff that it's more tax breaks for billionaires. And so I was able to explain this, that true in many cases, but they have a choice of where to put their money. And if this money, rather than going to a new shopping mall out in the suburbs or, you know, a football stadium or something, it goes to a distressed community that gets a brownfield sites cleaned up and redeveloped and provides, you know, a new grocery store for an area that was a food desert or such. That's what this is intended to do, to drive money to provide that kind of thing. And it was interesting having that perspective. I got a different reaction from them and more enthusiasm for moving the money along and moving the program along. Is there a similar story here, Liz, for these kind of credits that isn't just giving money back to big corporations, but instead is accomplishing some societal good?
Yeah, absolutely. And I see a real analogy to what you described around the opportunity zones. These carbon capture projects are costly. The equipment, it can be costly to not only acquire, but install and maintain. In some facilities, the cost of maintenance of carbon capture equipment can be very expensive. And then let's remember that in order to qualify for the credits, you not only have to have the equipment to capture the CO2 from the emission source, but you also have to properly dispose of it, inject it for EOR or EGR, or utilize it in a product. And because that is an emerging industry, the utilization of CO2, there is a cost associated with the emitter that adds the carbon capture equipment to pay for the cost of transporting that CO2 and also storing or utilizing that CO2. In some circumstances, emitters are paid for the CO2 that they deliver for oil or gas enhanced recovery or for utilization, but not in all cases. In some cases, they are paying those providers for the services. So there is a significant cost to many in adding carbon capture to their facilities. So what these credits are intended to do, and they only have a lifespan of 12 years, they're not perpetual. And what they are really intended to do is to encourage taxpayers to add carbon capture to their operations, to decarbonize their operations, and provide a mechanism for them to cover the costs. Because if you think about the projects that I've just described, in many cases, there is no revenue source. Adding the carbon capture equipment is a cost. Paying for the transport of the CO2 to the appropriate destination is a cost. Disposal of CO2 underground certainly is a cost. Mm-hmm. And in the case of utilizing the CO2 for EOR or another commercial purpose, there may be a payment for the CO2, but that is usually nominal. So that adding carbon capture to decarbonize your operations generally is a fairly costly venture that many taxpayers may not be incentivized to add, particularly if they don't have the liquidity to do so, without some sort of federal incentive. And again, they are time limited. They are only 12 years. They're not perpetual. So they're largely intended to allow the taxpayers to have a mechanism to cover some or all of those costs, not necessarily to earn a profit as a result of the credits.
That's helpful, because I suppose the idea with the limited period of time in which these carbon credits are available, the government is expecting or hoping that major industrial players will adopt the equipment early on, right? Because I think that probably, I mean, Liz, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like the groups that we're describing here are all sort of early adopters in emerging industries, right? These are like the people that went out and bought the first iPhone on the first day while we were all still walking around with our flip phones, right? And so bringing more of those people in is one of the main goals. And it sounds like you're seeing the effects of that in your work. You're seeing more people ask questions about carbon capture, how to obtain and monetize these credits. And so that's interesting.
And it's becoming bigger and bigger. We probably have well in excess of 20 active projects right now at the firm in all aspects, capturing CO2 from emitters, pipeline projects, sequestration projects, EOR projects. So the carbon capture industry isn't a singular industry. Mm-hmm. It's really multiple industries that have arisen, including technology companies, equipment providers, equipment operators, pipeline companies, some of which are converting historic natural gas pipelines to use to transport CO2, development of sequestration sites, utilization. And we also expect over time, while utilization of CO2, so for example, utilizing industrial source CO2 for carbonization of beverages, producing certain products, producing cement, is all in its early stages. But we expect that that is a use of CO2 that is going to grow over time. And ideally, that those will become markets that create further demand for CO2, driving up the price for industrial capture of CO2 or direct air capture of CO2, which will help pay for the development and maintenance of carbon capture facilities without government incentives.
The image of a fizzy water sold at Whole Foods with a caption of CO2 brought to you by your local refinery carbon capture systems. It's an interesting perspective.
It is. It's an interesting image, but it's quickly becoming reality.
Well, and one of my favorite beverages, and this is, I think, required of all of us in Texas, is Topo Chico, which may be the most fizzy of all of the carbonated beverages. And I sort of think that you need an air permit to just pop the cap on one of those. But I think, Liz, you talk about how so many different industries within the energy sector are pivoting to dealing with carbon dioxide, whether that's a midstream company that is designing a carbon dioxide pipeline and is, you know, looking for approvals of that pipeline, or a variety of, you know, sequestration facilities, you name it. One of the things that's interesting to me, and one of the reasons we thought this would be such a good topic, is that we think tax and environmental professionals should probably be talking to each other about these subjects a lot. But you know, when I think of like carbon capture, I think of the Seinfeld episode. And I don't know if either of you are Seinfeld fans, but one of my favorite scenes in Seinfeld is this moment where Jerry goes to a Hertz Rent-A-Car enterprise or something. And he says, all right, I have a reservation. Where's my car? And they say, you don't have your car. And he says, I think you're mistaken. I made a reservation. And the lady at the counter says, no, I understand you made a reservation and we just don't have your car. He's like, I don't think you understand reservations. Anyone can just take reservations. What matters is holding the reservation. And I think about that with carbon capture, right? Anyone can maybe put carbon dioxide through a device. What matters is that it's held. So that's a long way to pivot to, you know, what are some of the risk areas that you see emerging in this area? Like what happens if a company captures carbon dioxide, sends it through a pipeline to a secure, I'm using air quotes, secure geologic storage facility, and there's a loss of capture or containment, right? And when you talked about how you could either get refunds from the government, right? Direct pay for your carbon credits, or maybe you enter into a transaction and you sell it for 90 cents on the dollar, but then the carbon dioxide, that credit represented, is back in the air. You know, what's happening in this world where we have this sort of environmental compliance obligation to keep the stuff in the ground, and then all of this economic activity built on the presumption that once you capture it, it stays captured.
Well, Daniel, that could be the best segue I have ever heard into carbon sequestration. But you're absolutely right. As I said before, in order to qualify for the credit, you have to own at least one component of the carbon capture equipment, and you either have to physically or contractually provide for its disposal in secure geologic storage, use for EOR or EGR or utilization. But focusing on sequestration, which under the regulations, maybe a little bit of a misnomer, includes disposal in subsurface storage, as well as EOR or EGR. But an important component, exactly as you said, is that the credits are only available if that CO2 goes underground and stays underground in the case of disposal or EOR or EGR. And there are many requirements to that. So in order to have a qualifying site, first for disposal, you need the appropriate underground injection control permit. That's either a Class 6 or a Class 2 permit in certain circumstances, or the proper EOR permitting. You also need a monitoring plan for the site. This is things you guys are expert in more than I am, and I will promote here because it's so well deserved. The expertise in our environmental team with Jeff Homestead, formerly of the EPA, who is incredibly knowledgeable on these issues around sequestration of CO2, and Sarah Bergen, who I work with as well. We would not have the CCUS practice that we have at Bracewell if not for the two of them and their incredible knowledge and depth in this industry. But you do have to be sure that that CO2 stays safely sequestered and not released into the atmosphere. And to your point earlier, what happens if that CO2 is released into the atmosphere? Obviously, that's a little bit more of a complex analysis with EOR or EGR because some CO2 would be anticipated to come to the surface in that process. But let's just take, for instance, we had a disposal well, Class 6 well. What would happen if you claimed credits for the CO2 injected into that well that comes back up and is released into the atmosphere? Well, as you may suspect, you are at risk of losing your credits. So there is a provision of the credits under Section 45Q referred to as credit recapture, which is a little bit misleading because there are two ways that you could potentially lose the credits. And that addresses what happens if the CO2 is released into the atmosphere. So taking a step back, while I was just talking about the sequestration site, in a typical carbon capture project, there are really two ways you can lose CO2. You could lose it in the pipeline, just through line loss, being transported to the site. site. So if it never makes its way into the site and underground, you obviously can't claim a credit. So typically that is addressed in transport services agreements with respect to the CO2. And then obviously once it's injected underground and it qualifies for the credits, if it comes back up, there is a risk of loss of those credits. So there are two rules. If the loss of CO2 in any year does not exceed the amount injected in that year, so say you inject 100 metric tons and 10 leak, then you can only claim the credit for the net amount, 90 metric tons in my example. Mm-hmm. If the amount that leaks in any year exceeds the amount stored in that year, for example, you stored 10 and lost 100, you need to carry back that excess loss. So in my example, 90 metric tons, and you carry it back up to 3 years on a LIFO basis. And you treat that CO2 effectively as if it were never injected. So you track back the CO2, you allocate it to the shippers in those years, and you effectively treat it as if that CO2 were never injected. The code, however, says you don't have to go back and amend your prior returns. You just effectively repay that credit amount that you previously claimed in the year that the leakage occurred. So carrying this risk of recapture notion into what I was talking about before in monetizing the credits, this is one of the reasons why I said that tax equity was slow to develop around carbon capture projects. A lot of those who were very comfortable in investing in tax equity and wind and solar projects where they really felt they understood the market, the technology, this concept of potential loss of CO2 and understanding the geology and the likelihood that that would happen and how much and when really was something that they had trouble getting comfortable with quickly. Plus, I think they were all anticipating that these credits would become transferable, which I think slowed the development of the tax equity market. But this is a risk to this day that when we look at the financing of projects, whether through tax equity investors, project financing from banks or other institutions, is a risk that is new to them, right? And it involves complex geology. It involves EPA permitting and monitoring. And it's a lot of science to kind of get your head around. So one of the ways that projects hope to mitigate the risk of that, whether it's an actual risk of CO2 leakage, which we generally understand in most projects is pretty low. Mm-hmm. Remember, the CO2 is stored in some cases, you know, a mile underground.
Yeah, it would take a tremendous amount
for that to come to the surface. Yeah. And to the extent that there is a risk or a perceived risk, because mm-hmm. sometimes all you need is a perceived risk when you're trying to get financing done, there is insurance coming into the market to insure against the leakage and the recapture of credits. That market is still evolving. Premiums generally still are high, but I think those folks are quickly coming up to speed and engaging with some of the best and brightest to understand how these sites operate, the plume, and the likelihood of escape of the CO2. And I think very quickly, that's going to become a more and more efficient market, making the pricing for insurance very reasonable and an effective and relatively inexpensive way to mitigate the risk of recapture, especially if you're talking about equity investments or financings that are in very large part based upon the credit values to be generated from these projects. Because as I said earlier, in some of these projects, there is no cash revenue generation other than the credits. And in others, there might be some, but it's usually not a substantial part of the returns.
So Stephen, let's send you back in-house for a moment. And the GC of the company that you're the EHS head for comes and is talking about, you know, well, we're going to be doing carbon capture now. We're going to be participating in this, this brave new world of addressing our carbon emissions. And what are some of your thoughts for what this looks like on the environmental side for making sure that you have full cooperation between what I've thought to, at least beforehand, before this point, were pretty separate divisions within a company, you know, their tax team and their environmental team?
There's a couple of interesting thoughts as I'm listening to this and playing that role. One is measurement of the tons. Any credit program monetizing things, you want to know that, you know, dollar's a dollar, ton's a ton, and making sure that we can verify the good, if you will, the simply the goes in as and the hopefully not goes out as accurately, so that we can, you know, whether it's auditing function comes in and checks, or the others, you know, if we had an equity investor, we can prove up that we met it, meet the IRS obligation. So that's one aspect that we'd want to make sure that we really had nailed down and the technology was there. A second area that concerns me is coming from manufacturing, projects never go as intended. Something comes up, and how do you do that, whether it's timelines are exceeded, you know, supposed to be starting on January 1 of 2027 and you miss it by a year. What does that do? How do you put that into documents and deal structures and such, that risk of time lapse, or, you know, the pipes don't fit, or you can't find the steel, you know, different things come up. So those are typical of any construction project. From a specifically environmental law aspect, this is something that I think industry may end up doing to itself. By incentivizing this and creating this carbon capture industry, you start proving up the technology. And if all these projects actually work and get better and more efficient, and history tends to tell us that they get cheaper and easier to do as the engineers learn, that it makes it a lot easier for the government to then require that in a rule, that you have now set that as the standard. And that may be one of the things to, you know, when you talk about some of the objections you get from the environmentalists and such, hey, we're allowing these oil and gas assets to last longer or such. Well, we're going to need them. You know, we can't flip the switch in January to all solar, wind, and never have any problems. There is a long transition period, and maybe never get to 100% transition. Mm-hmm. This kind of technology helps you achieve that goal of net zero. And the sooner it gets up and running and working out the technical kinks and prove it up, it makes it easier then to put it into rules and mandate that it be done and make it part of every day. You know, I go back to my prior life. You look at the chemical plants. There were plants built in the 60s where there was no recycle of water. There was a big river there. We don't need to worry about that. Water was used once through. Now, every molecule of water is very carefully treated, handled, and such. You know, heat loss. You had steam dripping everywhere in the 70s and 80s. Energy got expensive. All of a sudden, steam traps, you know, all sorts of controls to be more efficient using energy. And so I think you see the same thing will happen here, is that rather than just CO2 going up the stacks, it gets captured. It becomes an asset that has to be managed. Now, it may not be a cash generating asset, but it's permission to continue to operate asset.
Right.
If we don't manage our CO2 right, if we don't manage our emission reductions of VOCs and other air things, we don't get to keep our permits. And so I think it becomes part of parcel of just everyday operations of facilities that have this carbon capture as part of it, just like every other environmental aspect as it grew up, has become part of just that's how we do business.
And thinking about the future of these credits, Stephen, and the future of these control technologies, Liz, I'd love to hear, I'm sure you're far deeper in this subject than we are, but I'm curious about what are there risks of future legislative activity? You know, Stephen talked about how some groups view carbon credits, they view carbon capture facilities as artificially prolonging the life of a dying industry. We know that it's not dying. We know that there's plenty of role for oil and gas moving forward, but there is opposition. There are groups that are opposed to these credits. So is there any risks of a future legislation that would make these credits less appealing, even as companies are trying to get projects up and running? Or do you see something going the totally opposite direction of that? And you know, people are more enthusiastic about these credits and more enthusiastic about these projects, and maybe Congress puts even more incentives out there and, you know, tweaking 45Q.
Great question. And it's a question that we get all the time. Obviously, you know, these credits were enhanced during a Democratic administration. And we often get asked if in the next election there is a Republican in the White House, there is a Republican Congress, do we expect that all of these will be repealed or reduced? Well, none of us obviously has a perfect view into the future, but our general expectation is that the credits will remain at least in their current form, even if they are not extended, through a change in administration, if that were to happen, a change in the control of the houses of Congress. And a number of reasons for that is, one, I think that The country has seen that these incentives are effective. I certainly believe that they have been a significant financial driver for a lot of the projects that we have already been involved in. And if not for these 45Q credits, we would not have seen these projects go forward. Mm-hmm. These projects are also driving a lot of investment in the United States, not only from domestic investors, but also foreign investors. Capital is coming into the United States. Foreign investors who are interested in investing in carbon capture and clean hydrogen and clean fuels are seeing the incentives that the U.S. has available. And for example, the EU does not have available to the same magnitude. And it's drawing a lot of capital into the U.S. Also, to maximize the value of a lot of these credits, you have to meet what's called the prevailing wage and apprenticeship rules under the IRA. And that generally means that the laborers on the site and the construction, alteration, or repair of the facility need to be paid prevailing wages. You also have to hire a requisite percentage of apprentices to work on the sites. So obviously, they have important social benefits as well. Mm-hmm. And they're really putting a lot of people to work in heavy industry. And for those reasons, I don't think that a mere change in control of the White House or the Houses of Congress would necessarily result in a complete sea change. Now, there were estimates of the cost of these credits when the IRA was enacted. And there is a question whether if so many different industries find these credits to be so attractive to drive new projects and the growth of CCUS and clean hydrogen and clean fuels projects really grow tremendously, whether the cost of the credits to the Treasury will be greater than they anticipated and what will happen if that occurs over time. I'll end on one last note. For those who may not appreciate this, the IRA was not necessarily a complete piece of legislation. And what I mean by that is there were provisions in a lot of these tax credit sections for energy transition that left open questions in order to determine exactly how to qualify for the credits or the magnitude of credits that would be available for your project. For example, the clean hydrogen credits are based in part on the measurement of the carbon footprint of the hydrogen you're producing. It's not limited to hydrogen produced from natural gas using steam methane reformation and CCUS or green hydrogen produced with renewable power and electrolysis. It's technology agnostic, but it does depend on the carbon footprint of the hydrogen that is produced. And they are yet to release guidance, which we are expecting in the fall, as to how to actually measure how clean your hydrogen is. So there is a lot of guidance that has been promulgated and we maintain on our Bracewell website. If you go in and search Inflation Reduction Act on the Bracewell.com website, that is providing all of the additional administrative guidance that has been promulgated since the IRA, filling in the details, in other words. And a lot of that guidance, I will say, has been taxpayer favorable, or at least, you know, clarified some of the details in what I think is a way that is fairly generous to taxpayers. And if the cost of these credits overall increase, will additional guidance be less generous to taxpayers? I think that remains to be seen, but I think that may be a more likely route to control the overall expanse of use of credits, more so than simply terminating the credits. Or I think least likely would be any sort of retroactive change in the credits, because already to date, it may not be public knowledge, but billions and billions of dollars been spent on developing not just carbon capture equipment, but entire carbon capture networks.
Well, Liz, I would imagine that you hear this a lot, but that was the most engaging and riveting conversation I've ever had about tax policy ever. So thank you for coming on the Environmental Law Monitor and sharing that with us. We'll have to have you back sometime to see what the state of the industry is in a year or two and see how these projects have gone from financing and R&D and plans and permit applications to, you know, real existing facilities out there in the world that you could drive up to and see them hopefully not releasing any carbon dioxide from their secure geologic sequestration. Stephen, any concluding thoughts on your end?
Just once again, thank you very much, Liz. I was incredibly insightful and actually generate some additional ideas for me as well. I think it will be interesting to see how this goes a few years down the road, where the credits go and such. You know, this is not the first time you've had tax credits and trying to spur an industry. And some of those programs have had long lasting effect and others not so much. So this will be interesting. I think if you get into that, there's too many people grabbing it, then that means it's being very successful and the technology's come along and it's working. And I can see them switching to other tools. Maybe it is requirements and rules or such to keep that going. But I would view that as a great success, in that if we're actually grabbing all that CO2 and more than we ever thought we could, wow, great. Good idea and good execution.
It's certainly been an exciting area to work in.
Well, thank you, Liz. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Dorn. Thank you, Emily. And thank you most of all, listeners, for putting up with a lack of updates from yours truly. We will be coming at you soon with new episodes. And I mean that this time. We'll see you later. Bye-bye.